Welcome to Good Evening, the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shame Utella, and joining me, as always, is my ever-constant co-host, Chris Haig. Chris, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I am finally conquering my fear of heights, and I'm going up a bell tower next. I'm so excited.
Oh, excellent. Right on. I'm so happy to hear that. You know, fear of heights is a very difficult thing for some people to get over, so... Tom wasn't able to make it today, and, you know, okay, look, it's not that he wasn't able to make it. I'll tell you what happened, okay? I went over to visit him, and he did this really, you know, tasteless, tacky thing. I was really upset at him. You know, I told him about this art piece that I was looking at, and he, like, painted himself on this art piece and didn't realize what I was going through internally. So, like, I just walked out, and I just, right now, I don't know when I'm going to see him again. I don't know if I can handle it. I mean, it was a good painting. He was really beautiful in that dress and with the flowers and whatnot, but, you know, he just didn't know what I was going through at the time. So, I didn't even tell him we were recording today.
I know we're joking. I would pay money to see that. More importantly, I think we should all have them done. If someone said, would you like an oil painting done, like, in Vertigo? I'm like, yeah.
Yes.
The other question is, how much of my money do you want?
Yes. Awesome. Well, filling in for Tom, somebody who I am not upset with for being so tacky, is our good friend Manish. How are you doing, Manish?
Oh, doing well. Thanks for having me back.
I am happy to have you here, and I'm happy to have you here for this one, because if I remember correctly, like, you love this movie.
Yeah, it's my number one favorite Hitchcock movie and number one favorite movie of all time.
Oh my goodness, so we got a home run here. We did a bases loaded home run on this one. Well, just in case you didn't know, we're actually going back in time and we're going to be covering Waltzes from Vienna. No, I'm kidding. We're covering Vertigo. We're covering Vertigo. This is the big one. You know, it's like, it's funny because I didn't get a chance to read it, but I have that Donald Spotto's 50 Years of Hitchcock Pictures or whatever it's called. I can't remember the exact name. I don't have it in the room here. And it's like early Hitchcock work. There's like a chapter and there's like a paragraph for each of these movies and whatnot. And then once you get to like the big films, like with Murder, then there's like a chapter that's like 5 or 6 pages and whatnot. And then like most of the chapters on the films are like, you know, at most, like lots of pictures take up like 12 or 13 pages with like, and that's chapters that have like one picture covering a whole page. The chapter on Vertigo is 30 pages long. Like, it's, like, super long compared to everything else. So, like, clearly, Spotto loves Vertigo as well. I think it's going to be his favorite film, so. But, yeah, this is definitely the one that, like, is a top contender for me. I don't know if I think it's my favorite Hitchcock film, but if it's not my favorite, it's number two. Like, I'm kind of dueling in my head right now between The Birds and Vertigo right now, you know? Like, I really love The Birds, so. And I think we'll discuss it. There's a couple of things that near the end and whatnot where I'm like, but, and like a couple of little changes that I think should be made. But I mean, like, you know, who am I? I'm not Hitchcock, right? So what the hell do I know?
Right.
So anywho, Manish, I don't know about Chris, but I live in a really small town. Well, not it's a city in Canada, but we don't get anything like that. But you live in New York, right?
That's correct.
Did you get to see Vertigo when it was in theaters? Like, what was it, last year?
No, because of I think I must have missed it. However, I have seen Vertigo on the big screen in New York. Oh gosh, three or four times, I think, somewhere in that. Because usually they do like a Hitchcocktober series where they'll show like a bunch of Hitchcock movies or like Fathom Events type or like, I don't know, some art house theater will randomly play it. So I've seen it on the big screen a number of times. And every time it's quite an experience. I feel like it's always a gamble seeing classic movies with a big with an audience, just because you might not get a great audience, you might get a very annoying audience. So I think only once was I like cringing at how annoying my audience was being. Most times it's been pretty solid. But yeah, I mean it's really quite a I mean I love seeing Hitchcock movies on the big screen. I've seen North by Northwest and Notorious on the big screen. I've seen The Birds and Psycho on the big screen. So, oh,
so jealous.
I think those are the main ones that get played. Like, I wish I could see like Shadow of a Doubt or, you know, or something a little one of the more lesser known ones. But usually it's like the same kind of six that get played.
Yeah. They had a reissued format of the film that came out last year, and I think they were like touring it around in 70 mil. And we got nothing like that here. I mean, we had 2001 play at our IMAX on 70 mil. And the neat thing about our IMAX is it's not digital. It's film, right? Like, it actually projects film. So I got to see, like, an actual film print of 2001 a couple years ago. And it comes back every once in a while. I haven't made the effort to go back again, but I did see it when they played it in 70 mil.
That must have been incredible.
Oh, man. You know what? Like, I loved that movie. Like, the first time I saw that movie when I was a kid, I like, hated it. I'm like, what is this trash? This is the worst movie ever made. And then, like, for some stupid reason, I kept watching this trash, right? And the more I watched it, the more I loved it. And now I just love 2001 A Space. Like, I think it's fantastic. But then seeing it on on an IMAX screen in 70 mil, like, it's a whole nother experience. There's so much detail that you just can't see even on your big TV, right? Like, yeah. I got a 65-inch TV and there's still stuff that you don't see on it. Like, it's just, it's something else to see it on that format.
Yeah.
I mean, because I've just come back off holiday, I got to experience something similar, not with Hitchcock, but because the ship I was on, they ran a big movie night. It was like an afternoon. There'd be like Black Widow or Cruella or the new Emma. And then randomly they're like, now we're going to play you a James Bond. So they put From Russia With Love on.
Oh, wow.
And I got, because I was the youngest person there by about 30 years. And so I just got to sit and just be like, okay, this is so cool. Sort of imagining what it'd be like 60, I think they said about 66 years or something.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember. No, actually, no, that's impossible. Like 58 years since From Russia With Love came out, and just seeing it on the big screen and hearing like the music and seeing people react to it, and yeah, it's just it's something so cool about it. So yeah, I am very jealous in that I have not been able to do a Hitchcock on the big screen yet, but hopefully I will get the opportunity to do so, because it sounds so fun.
Yeah, I've seen a couple. I saw they played Creature from the Black Lagoon here in the city a couple years ago, and they played it in 3D.
Oh,
so
wow.
I made sure that cool. I went to see that. I took Aubrey to see that. And I saw Wizard of Oz once, and a couple other ones. But the last one I went to, actually just went this last week there. I took Aubrey to see. They played Spirited Away for the 20th anniversary.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah, so good. I watched it for the first time in Japanese. I usually watch it dubbed. Like, I'm a film buff, and I usually watch things in their original language. But animated movies and comedies, I tend to prefer the dubbed versions, because with animated, I'm like, it's kind of weird, because it doesn't matter. Like, the voice is, you know, I don't know. Right. To me, it doesn't matter, right? I don't know if that's blasphemy or whatever. But with comedies, though, I have a hard time interpreting. Because I watch so many foreign movies, I'm like, I don't know if these guys are good or bad actors, because I don't understand what they're saying, right? I'm reading the subtitles, and I'm putting my own inflection on what I'm reading. So, like, if I put a comedy on, I'm like, it's not funny, because I'm not reading it as funny. I put on Kung Fu Hustle, and I'm watching it in Chinese, and I'm like, this isn't funny. Like, I'm just watching this as a movie. So I switched it to the dub version and then laughed my butt off, you know, so. But anyways, yeah, because it worked better that way for me. So, anywho, we're not talking about Fathom Events here. We don't need to talk about that. We're talking about Vertigo. So I'm going to just jump into our trivia here. Actually, before I do that, Chris, do you got a quick summary for us?
An ex-police officer who suffers from an intense fear of heights is hired to prevent an old friend's wife from committing suicide, but all is not as it seems. Hitchcock's haunting, compelling masterpiece is uniquely revelatory about the director's own predilections and hang-ups, and is widely considered to be one of his masterworks.
Okay, I have umbrage with that summary there, because he wasn't hired to prevent her suicide.
I mean, he was and he wasn't, because, like...
He's hired a follower, right?
Yeah, yeah, but I think part of it is also, like, you know, if he's, like, following you, I'm like, yeah, well, she's dead now. I followed her all the way till she threw herself in, you know, in the ocean.
Into the ocean and whatnot. Awesome. Okay, well, let's go through our trivia and behind the scenes on the film here before we start discussing it. Vertigo is a 1958 American film noir psychological thriller directed and produced by Alfred Hitchcock. The story was based on the 1954 novel D'Entre les Morts, which translates as From Among the Dead, by Boulot Narsajak. And I hope I'm saying that right. The screenplay was written by Alec Koppel and Samuel L. Taylor. It was shot on location in the city of San Francisco, California, as well as Mission San Juan Batista, Big Basin Redwoods State Park, and Cypress Point on the 17-mile drive, and Paramount Studios in Hollywood. It is the first time to use the dolly zoom, an in-camera effect that distorts perspective to create disorientation to convey Scotty's acrophobia. As a result of its use in film, the effect is often referred to as the Vertigo effect. Now, Vertigo received mixed reviews upon its initial release, but is now often cited as a classic Hitchcock film and one of the defining works of his career. Attracting significant scholarly criticism, it replaced Citizen Kane as the greatest film ever made in the 2012 British Film Institute's Sight and Sound Critics Poll. The film is often considered one of the greatest films ever made, and it's appeared repeatedly in polls of the best films by the American Film Institute, including a 2007 ranking as the 9th greatest American movie of all time. In 1996, the film underwent a major restoration to create a new 70mm print and DTS soundtrack. In 1989, Vertigo was one of the first 25 films selected by the Library of Congress for preservation in the United States National Film Registry for being culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. It has a release date of May 9th, 1958, running time of 128 minutes, and did pretty well at the box office, $2.5 million budget with a $7.3 million box office. Now, Vertigo was filmed from September to December of 1957, and principal photography began on location in San Francisco in September under the working title From Among the Dead, which is the translation of the title. The film uses extensive location footage of the San Francisco Bay Area with its steep hills and tall arching bridges. In the driving scenes shot in the city, the main characters' cars are almost always pictured heading down the city's steeply inclined streets. In October of 96, the restored print of Vertigo debuted at Castro Theater in San Francisco with a live on-stage introduction by Kim Novak, providing the city a chance to celebrate itself. Visiting the San Francisco film locations has something of a cult following, as well as a modest tourist appeal. Such a tour is featured in a subsection of the Chris Marker's documentary montage Sans Soleil. The scene in which Madeline falls from the tower was filmed at Mission San Juan Batista, a Spanish mission in San Juan Batista, California. Associate producer Herbert Coleman's daughter, Judy Lanini, suggested the mission to Hitchcock as a filming location. A steeple added sometime after the mission's original construction and secularization had been demolished following a fire, so Hitchcock added a bell tower using scale models, matte paintings, and trick photography at the Paramount Studio in Los Angeles. The original tower was much smaller and less dramatic than the film's version, and the tower's staircase was later assembled inside a studio. Both Vera Miles, who had starred in Hitchcock's previous film, The Wrong Man, and James Stewart, were attached to the project at an early stage, and Stewart became a financial partner, sharing in any profits the film made. However, Stewart wasn't the first name linked to the film, and the initial press reports in October of 55 stated that Hitchcock was keen for Cary Grant to play the lead role. That would have been an interesting change, eh? Although commonly reported that Miles' pregnancy was the sole reason she was dropped from the film, author Dan Oler, Oler has claimed that both Hitchcock and Stewart had reservations about her ability to make an impact in the role and were considering alternative actresses as early as November of 1956, whilst Miles was undergoing makeup, hair, and costume tests for the role of Madeline. Ultimately, the delays of the starting of the filming date meant that Miles' pregnancy would be too obvious, and as soon as she pulled out in March of 57, Kim Novak was announced as her replacement, and no other actresses were considered for the role. Now, this film has been on many lists, as we've said. So AFI's 100 Films, 100 Movies from 1998. This was number 61. 100 Years from AFI, 100 Years, 100 Thrills. It was number 18. 100 Years, 100 Passions. It was number 18 in 2002. 100 Years of Film Scores. This was number 12. I think this is my favorite Bernard Herrmann film score that he's done with Hitchcock, though. Like, this music is just chef's kiss. 100 Years, 100 Movies, the 10th Anniversary Edition, it made it to number 9. And AFI's 10 Top 10 for Mystery, this was number 1. Now, we spoke of Jimmy Stewart when we covered Rope. This is his fourth and final Hitchcock appearance, and we shall miss him. Now, Marilyn Pauline Kim Novak was born on the 13th of February, 1933, and she's an American retired film and television actress. Novak began her film career in 1954 after signing with Columbia Pictures and subsequently became one of Hollywood's top box office stars, starring in many movies, including Picnic, The Man with the Golden Arm, and Pal Joey. She's widely known for her performance as Madeline Elster and Judy Barton in Vertigo, and the film was ignored by critics upon its release, but is now recognized as one of the greatest films ever made. Other notable films by her include Belle, Book, and Candle, Strangers When We Meet, and Kiss Me Stupid. Although still only in her mid-30s, Novak withdrew from acting in 1966 and has only sporadically worked in films since. She appeared in The Mirror Cracked from 1980 and had a regular role on the primetime series Falcon Crest from 86 to 87. After a disappointing experience during the filming of Liebstrom in 91, she permanently retired from acting, saying she had no desire to return. Her contributions to cinema have been honored with 2 Golden Globe Awards, an honorary Golden Bear Award, and a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame. Novak is a painter and visual artist, and this is her only Hitchcock appearance. Barbara Bel Geddes was an American stage and screen actress, artist, and children's author whose career spanned almost 5 decades. She was best known for her starring role as Miss Ellie Ewing in the television series of Dallas, and Bel Geddes also starred as Maggie in the original Broadway production of Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Another notable film that she was in was I Remember Mama. Throughout her career, she was the recipient of several acting awards and nominations. And while this is her only Hitchcock film, she is in 4 episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents. The Fog Home, Lamb to the Slaughter, which I guess, did we cover that recently? It's hard to tell when we recorded this. We either just recently covered that for our Hitchcock episodes, or it's coming up right away here. And then an episode called The Mourning of the Bride and Sibylla. And oh boy, that Sibylla, what an episode that Sibylla is. That is the craziest episode of Hitchcock Presents. Tom Helmore was an English film actor. He appeared in more than 50 films between 1927 and 1972, including 3 directed by Hitchcock. Helmore was born in London, England, and died in Longboat Key, Florida, USA. Helmore worked in his father's accounting firm while working as an extra in films. He subsequently pursued acting as a career, working predominantly on the stage and later on Broadway, which led to Helmore's Hollywood career. In British and American films, Helmore was mostly employed as a dapper comedic actor, even if he was best known for his role as the villain Gavin Elster in Vertigo. So with Hitchcock, he had 2 previous uncredited roles in The Ring from 1927 and Secret Agent from 1936. This will be his last film appearance with Hitchcock, but he's also in 2 episodes of Hitchcock Presents, Little White Frock and Murder Me Twice. And last but not least, Hitchcock's cameo in Vertigo occurs about 10 minutes in the films. While we're waiting for Scotty to arrive at Elster's shipyard, Hitchcock walks across from left to right carrying what appears to be a bugle case. The scene was shot on the Paramount lot on Thursday, the 19th of December, close to the studio's prop department. And that's all we got for today. Manish, where do you want to start?
Well, I want to start with one thing that you mentioned, which is Bernard Herrmann.
Yes.
Because I think that he is one of the main reasons why this movie has been lodged in my brain since I first saw it in 2009. And I remember the first time I saw it, I had nightmares from it. Not because it was... I mean, this movie isn't scary in the sense that, like, Psycho is scary. But it is very... It gets into your head. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of that is the music. You know, the influence from Wagner and Tristan Isolde and sort of the very, like, loopy, circular, you know, ups and downs in the mm-hmm. score. Like, it just gets in your head. And I think that, you know... For anyone who has not seen this movie yet, which, you know, I can't imagine that you're listening to Hitchcock podcast without having seen Vertigo, but, you know, I think that, I think that's, like, the main thing that I would want someone to take away from this movie if they, you know, if they didn't like the movie, which is fine, but I would hope they come away thinking that it's one of the best scores ever written. Mm-hmm. And, I find the score to be so unsettling, but also it's kind of like this. Oddly enough, this movie has become like a comfort movie for me because I've seen it so many times that like whenever I take like an exam or something, I watch it the night before, and I've been doing that for like almost every exam I've taken in the last like 7 years. And like as Chris knows, I'm going back to school, so. Mm-hmm. I've been watching it, like, before my entrance exam. I'll be watching it before my finals are coming up. So I find that, like, the repetitiveness, the circular aspect, the loops in the film, I think are not just in the score, but I think that the more you watch this movie, the more you'll notice how it repeats itself so many mm-hmm. times. You know... You've returned back to scenes and locations. Phrases of dialogue are repeated. You know, obviously, you know, there's Madeline and there's Judy, which is another repeat. So I think that, like, for me, what I really take away from this movie is just the structure of it, the music of it, the dialogue. I mean, it's, like I said, it's like, I consider this like a 10 out of 10 perfect movie. I've seen it a million times. I have it memorized. But I think the sort of like circle elements to it, I think are really what really strike gold for me.
Well, let me ask you this question. So, like, with this music being... Like, I love this. I think the opening title is beautiful, beautiful music here. Does this music work better in the main title of Vertigo, or in the opening of Lady Gaga's Born This Way?
That's... Is it Born This Way or Bad Romance?
It's Born This Way.
I think
way.
It's Born This Way, yeah.
I mean, I think she... I feel like you're joking, but...
Nope. Nope. No, he's...
I think she... No, I mean, it's...
I am joking, but yes.
I love it, because you basically got... So Minnie's just like, great, do you want your queer card revoked, or do you want your film nerd card revoked? Choose!
I love Lady Gaga, and I think she is very, very schooled in sort of the classic era. And I don't think she did that intentionally or flippantly. Because I know Bad Romance also has references to Hitchcock as well. And so many Hitchcock movies are bad romances. Yeah, I mean, I think it works well in the film. It works even better Lady Gaga. You know, she elevates it. Look, I'm a Lady Gaga fan, so that's the answer you should have expected from me.
I mean, listen, she's my... pop star, you know, like some people have Madonnas. I'm like, no, for me it was Gaga, so I am 100% with Manish on this. I'm like, no, she basically took a really good reference and changed it and turned it to something else and gave it new life and a new resonance.
Yeah.
So, yeah, why not? And plus it means that a secret generation of kids who have not seen Vertigo have heard the score. Because it's at the start of the video. So, it's pretty cool.
Excellent, Rainer. Chris, did you want to say anything about the film score before we jump into anything else?
I mean, he's just covered it, really, but it's just, it is one of these striking, beautiful scores. I mean, it's also been repeated, as a lot of Bernard Herrmann stuff is. There's a TV show called Homecoming, which is on Amazon, and it's an adaptation of a podcast. Well, the first season uses a lot of Bernard Herrmann's scores from Psycho and Vertigo as part of the instrumental music. So there's been times when I've sat, and they use the Vertigo one, but it's the reverse of the Vertigo shot. So it's as a character is going down this spiral staircase, they're playing the music, and I'm like, oh, this is cool. This is a director who gets it, so it's really fun and everything. But yeah, I just think it's such a... It's weird, it's beautiful, and it's mesmerising, and there's like moments when sort of Carlotta's painting is revealed, and it's like, oh, this is... You know, it's the double of Madeline, and it's all this kind of thing, and it's these brilliant motifs that come in, and it's beautiful, and it's shocking, and it's... really helps carry you away on the film. And I get exactly what Manish is on about, where, you know, it's not this film, but for me it's Psycho. If I'm ever like sick or if I'm tired or anything, I'll put Psycho on, because even though it's like dark and disturbing, I'm like, no, I've seen it like 50 times.
Yeah.
It's fine. I like the music. I like the soft-spoken ASMR kind of parts of it. I'm like, oh no, this is just going to soothe me, even as people are getting stabbed to death.
Yeah, Tony Perkins.
Oh.
Very good ASMR.
Well, yeah, and there's like the conversation at the beginning where it's the guy with the oh my god, how much money is it? That is how long it's been.
$40,000.
That's it. Thank you. Like the $40,000, he's like talking low, and I'm like, oh yes, this is just soothing. But it is funny because you can buy like the Herrmann scores on vinyl, and I've nearly done it. But I'm like, they are supposed to be just kind of striking and dramatic. But ironically, I'm like, oh no, this is just like easy listening to me. I'd have this on when people come round for dinner. I'm like, yeah. Do you want to hear the stab motif? I'm there like, do 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 do. Having fun with it. But no, I mean, it's sort of, we'll get into it more when we talk about the actual film, but the beautiful thing about the score is it's a beautiful entity on its own, but it really helps create a film that is sort of more than the sum of its parts. So yeah, I just love it. I think it's great. I think it's one of the soundtracks that I would turn to again and again. And yeah, more love for Bernard Herrmann, basically.
Yeah. I love this one. It's definitely my favorite Hitchcock score. I can understand if people would think North by Northwest might be a better score, but I personally think this one's better myself. Mm. But I think nobody can disagree that this is definitely a better score than The Birds, right?
Well, I mean, I was going to make that joke about Rear Window, and then I went, oh yeah, there is actually a bit of music at the end that I quite like. Yeah. And I've been like, oh, I did shoot myself in the foot there. Damn it.
Yes. Yes. Deep cut Hitchcock joke for those that don't get it. There's no score in the words. So. Okay, so let's jump into the film. I want to start with the thing that, like, I'm like, okay, I didn't like this. The ending of this film pisses me off, like just how abruptly it ends. So we're starting right at the very end. So she like falls out the window, like the
spoiler alert.
Oh, you've seen the movie. Every single movie. So he goes up there to confront her and say, look, I know that you were actually this woman, and I know that this was all a scheme and whatnot. She falls out the window and it's done. It agitates me that is done so quickly. But I mean, like, that is also kind of a thing of movies of this era. And it's definitely a thing of Hitchcock where, like, the movies just end, you know? But this one here, to me, I'm like, I kind of need a bit more myself. And I need to see the husband, like, go to jail or something.
So,
because
did you watch the alternate ending then?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So that is the alternate ending. So basically, all that happens, and then the alternate ending's like a minute-long scene where it's Scotty and Midge in Midge's apartment, and over the radio it sort of says, oh, Gavin Elster's been captured and all that sort of thing, and it's just the pair of them, and it's a silent scene apart from the radio, and the two of them are just sort of like shocked. I think they're holding hands or something. I think it's just like, dealing with the aftermath thing. So I think they did film it, and you can find it on YouTube and everything.
I think it's on the DVD release. I just didn't watch it.
It is.
So.
Yeah. Oh, is it? It's not very good. I mean, I would watch it out of curiosity, but I don't think it would have helped. I don't think it would have helped your concern.
Yeah. Right. So, Manish, tell me why I'm wrong.
So here's why you're wrong. No, but I think this might be a little bit of a long-winded answer, but I think that Vertigo, at its heart, is a tragedy. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very sad movie, because it's about two people, Judy and Scotty, who are just so lost, and they're despairing, and they are looking for some kind of, you know, connection or whatever, and they... two lost souls who find each other, and, you know, all their psycho romance goes on. And I think the reason why the movie ends the way it does, and the reason why the alternate ending doesn't work at all, is because, for me personally, I think Scotty, the movie ends the way that it does because it puts Scotty in the same position that he was at the end of the prologue, when he's on the roof and his police captain or his, you know, other detective falls off the roof and he's hanging from the roof. He's like suspended, and you know, there's a reason why Hitchcock doesn't show how he gets out of that position. It's because he spends that entire movie suspended in air with really no way out. And so I think essentially the ending of the film is really a replay of that, because he might get cured of his vertigo by being able to, you know, go up the stairs to the top of the tower, which he couldn't do in the middle of the film, but someone still died, and he's still stuck at the top looking down without really anywhere to go from here, emotionally, mentally. You know, and so he can go back to San Francisco, he can hang out with Matt, with Midge, he can, you know, but he essentially, he's just always going to be suspended like that at the top looking down and with the despair. And I think that there's really no way for this movie to end happily, in my opinion. I think that, you know, if he were to have forgiven Judy and they got together, I mean, that'd be a happy ending, but it wouldn't make sense for me. You know, showing Gavin Elster get caught, I mean, I think that Gavin Elster and Madeline, they're the MacGuffin of the movie. You know, Madeline's actually the MacGuffin of her own movie. We actually don't even meet the real Madeline, which is something that, like, didn't really click for me until, like, the 12th time I've seen it. I was like, wait, we actually don't even know the real Madeline, what she was like, or no one seems to even care about her murder. In fact, you know, when Judy is writing the letter, you know, she's like, you were the victim, but actually, Scotty wasn't the victim, Madeline was the victim, the real Madeline. So I think that there's really no way for this movie to end in any other way than the way it does. I agree with you that old movies tend to just kind of end. There's really no denouement for a lot of them. You know, I think nowadays we'll see a movie where the climax happens, like the big battle, you know, if it's an action movie or something, and then there's like an epilogue where everyone gets back together. Or in a horror movie, there is that scene that, like, you know, 10 a.m. the next day when everyone is, you know, surviving and there's police cars or whatever. You don't see that a lot with older film. I think they just kind of end. Mm-hmm. Whether that's better or worse than it is now, I can't tell you. I mean, I think that in some cases it works really well, like in Vertigo, in my opinion, but in some cases it doesn't work. And it's also not universally true. I mean, I think Rear Window has an epilogue, kind of, you know, with... you know, that sort of like that next morning, bright morning glow. And so, but I think with Vertigo, it's this idea of it's a tragic mystery romance thriller. And there's just no cure for Scotty's condition. You know, because regardless, anytime he goes up top, someone seems to die. Whether it's his police captain or whoever. And I don't think it's a captain, I think it's just another detective. Whether it's the other detective or the original real Madeline or Judy, you know, he gets up there and something happens. So to me, that's why that works.
Yeah.
Chris, what are your thoughts on the ending?
I mean, I'm someone who loves a happy ending. I'm someone who loves resolution and closure and kind of all that stuff coming together. However, I do completely agree with Manish, because if you view Scotty as sort of a tragic hero who is both kind of self-destructive and other-destructive, then that's the only way it can end, really, with the amount of stuff he does. Because, you know, over the course of the film, he ends up pushing away everyone in his life. So he pushes... he pushes Midge away, he causes Madeline's death, he causes Judy's death, he just sort of self-isolates and becomes this sort of bitter focused character. And you know, there is something that is sort of Greek tragic about him. He is a sort of Byronic tragedy of a man who is unable to escape these sort of patterns and unable to escape these sort of behaviours. And you know, like Minnie said, he's sort of permanently suspended. He's neither on top of his situation, nor is he falling into the deep abyss of it. There's a reason why the most powerful image that we have during that sort of dream sequence that kind of breaks the film in two is of him falling and suspended and spirals, and it's so full of this kind of interesting imagery that really speaks to, oh well, here's a guy who is literally trapped in a negative downward spiral that he's unable to, you know, get away from. You know, he's an obsessive character who he starts off, you know, having rejected one woman who kind of is the real world, who is stability, who is you know, security and comfort and safety, and he pursues another woman who is the very opposite. She's mystery and danger, and she's literally not a real person. She's, you know, an elaborate ruse constructed. And he keeps rejecting them, and he keeps trying to find ways to reject them. So Midge survives, but it's only because, you know, she chooses to leave when Scotty's in the psychiatric ward going through all the music therapy. She chooses to walk away. That's the last time we see of her. And in a way, it's good that that is the last we see of her, because who knows what else she could have been caught up with if she'd stayed in kind of Scotty's self-destructive spiral. So the ending, in a way, I mean, I wish there'd been a moment which either would have set up or would have clarified the thing with the nun a bit more, because I don't, because the moment plays out kind of, yeah, Scotty's forcing Judy up the stairs, and he's saying like, oh well, you did this and I worked it out, and kind of, ah, you traitor, all that sort of thing is going on. And then they reach the top and he's realised, oh my god, I look down, and then this figure steps out of the shadows, and Judy sort of just goes, oh no, and takes a step back and she falls. And it isn't, because I've seen some people say, oh, she killed herself. I'm like, well no, it's obviously played more like, oh, it's an accidental
right
death. Right. But I just, if there'd been something that set it up a bit more, whether she thinks it's Gavin or she thinks it's like the spirit of the real Madeline who's come back to haunt her, or if it was, I just wish there'd been something to have set that up, either in the moment with a bit of dialogue, or if there'd been something earlier in the film which was kind of like, oh well, you know, I don't know, just something. I think that would have helped, because it is very abrupt, and it is very much a case of she steps off, falls to her death, oh my god, bell starts ringing, he looks out, he's able to look down in a sort of reverse of Madeline, quote-unquote Madeline's death, and then also of his dream, and you know, this recurring motif throughout of kind of heights and all that sort of thing. So I'm sort of in two camps. I completely agree that Scotty's fate is the only way it could have ended, but I do wish they'd have set up like little bits with sort of Judy's death a bit more, because, and yeah, the other thing I kind of wish as well, but this is just again because I like closure, would have been nice to have seen Gavin kind of canonically get comeuppance, because he escapes. He is the main villain of the film, and he gets away with killing his presumably innocent wife.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Judy who pays the price, but that, I suppose, gets into a deeper conversation about gender within the film, kind of like how the women are the ones who are continually punished, and the men get away with killing them.
Right, because, like looking at this film from the years that it's done, like, this is 1958, so, like, I don't know how much guilt as a viewer, like, I'm not a lawyer, right, so I don't know how much guilt would end up being put on Judy at the end of it all. Like, if this were to go to court, if she didn't die,
yeah,
like, how much time would she spend in jail for this? Somebody, like, paid her or forced her or bribed her to do this, you know, to play this role and whatnot. But it's like, we know how men can treat women, right? And it's like, you get to a certain point, like, maybe she couldn't have, like, escaped this somehow. We never see exactly how she got involved in this situation, right?
To me, that's one of the big mysteries of the film, and one that I alternate between wanting to know the solution of, and also one that I don't want to know about.
So you don't want a Netflix movie where we see how Judy got involved with this?
There is a novel called The Testament of Judith Barton.
Okay.
And it reimagines Vertigo from her perspective. I have not read the novel. I've only heard about it. I'd be interested in reading it, just because it's not coming, it's not a canon thing, it's not coming from Hitchcock, it's coming from, you know, a separate author, so it's their interpretation. I think that'd be interesting to look at.
Yes.
Because I have my own theories about how Judy got into the position that she got in. I have my own theories about Madeline as well,
mm-hmm.
What she was like. And I think part of the allure for me of Vertigo is that these mysteries, these stories aren't being told. And that, you know, I mean, we can, the three of us can sit down and have three different theories about how Judy got involved with Gavin, you know, whether they were having an affair, whether he found her and coerced her into it, whether he misled her, we don't know. And I think from a legal perspective, I am a lawyer. I don't quite know what her involvement would be like. I think she would definitely be kind of an accomplice, but I it would depend on what her background is, right? Like,
yeah.
If she was coerced, and I think there's probably evidence that she was, because
right.
She's a poor single shop girl, you know, living in a hotel, and he's this rich, powerful baron. I'm sure that he forced her to do it, maybe not violently, but in some kind of manipulative way. But I think that, to me, the movie is somewhat, this might get me in trouble, but I think this movie is somewhat more rich for not having explored the backstories of Madeline, Judy, or even Midge.
Yeah, I would agree.
Because I think that the, because it's such an interior psychological romance, that to explore more, I think would removed some of the mystery of it, would remove some of the alluring, seductive qualities of the film for me.
Right. I would absolutely agree with that, because when I was done watching this movie, the first thing I did was start to think about it. And, like, I started to think about certain things, and I'm like, okay,
yeah.
So was when she jumped in the river supposed to be the suicide, and then it backfired because he saved her? And then I'm like, no, because... Then I realized what you said you realized. I'm like, no, we actually didn't see Madeline, the real Madeline, the whole movie. We only saw Judy the whole time.
Right, right.
So it was meant that she was supposed to jump in the river and be saved. So was him falling in love with her not planned? Like, these were all things that it's like, I sat here and thought about this movie for quite a while after watching it. And, as I said, this is only the second time that I've seen the movie. I saw it once quite a few years ago, and I just finally got to it a second time for this podcast here. But yeah, it made me think about it. I do think that is what makes the movie rich, is that it doesn't leave with you. It sticks with you. Lots happens in this. You know,
yeah.
The pacing of it is, like, amazing. Like, with Scotty following her and just looking at her face and seeing her everywhere, and then, like, seeing the obsession and the love that he had for this woman, you know, by showing Kim Novak in all these like quick shots where he thinks he's seeing her, but he's not actually seeing her. You know, like that stuff is really, really well done, and it's conveyed really well in the film. And you know, when he finally sees Judy and is like, this is crazy how much this woman looks like her, we get this whole side tangent on this, and it's like, where is this film going? What's happening here, right? Like, watching it like this time was like I watched it for the first time, because I didn't remember much. I remember that something happened up there, but I couldn't remember what it was, right, until the end. So, but the other problem that I had with the film was, I think this is, it actually diverges from the original book in this point, is that we get the flashback of what Judy did in the letter. We get the explanation early on in the film. And I'm like, I don't know if I would like that to not be there. And we don't get that reveal until the end. Because now our perception of Judy is colored. Now our perception of Judy is what she's done. And waiting for Scotty to figure it out, right? Where, so I think it, because we know that at the end of the movie, at some point, he's going to realize who she is and what she did. That's how the movie's going to end. So, I don't know, to me, that kind of affects the movie in a different way than I get. It looks like the original novel intended. I don't think they find that out until the very end scene in the novel. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big debates about the movie that I've come across. In any time I've talked about this movie or read about it or discussed it with, you know, friends and stuff. And I mean, I think that for me, when Judy kind of when Scotty leaves her hotel room, and to me that symbolizes some kind of like protagonist switch. Similar to Psycho, where you have Marion Crane, and then, you know, she dies in the shower, and then almost immediately Norm Bates becomes the new protagonist. And it kind of shifts the movie and, like, turns it on its head. And I think with Vertigo, it does a similar thing where, you know, we're following Scotty for the first, you know, two-thirds of the movie, and then Judy gets introduced, and I think the movie switches protagonists at that point and becomes less about who is Judy and more about when will the secret come out. And to me, like, I think that by giving that last act of the movie to Judy as the protagonist, and by letting us know what she did and how she was involved, I think it maybe takes away some of the, you know, the mystery of it, but also I think adds to like the emotional suspense, because now we have, you know, she's in love with him, he's in love with what he thinks is, you know, like, he's in love with a ghost who's actually her, and it's just like, when will this kind of explode in their faces, and when will he find out? And then, because you get that amazing sequence where they're getting dressed to go to the steakhouse, and he helps her put on the necklace that Judy wore, or sorry, that Madeline wore, and he doesn't even notice it until he sees it in the mirror. And then you get the callback to the painting. Mm-hmm. And you wouldn't have that moment if they saved the reveal until the end. Or you would have it, but it just, because it almost catches Judy off guard. I don't think she even was thinking about, you know, wearing that necklace. I think she's put it on because it was available to her.
See, I think that is the reveal, and that's when Scotty would start to figure it out. Like, what? Like, again, sitting back and thinking on it, I'm like, well, yeah. When would it have been if they took it out? It would be at that moment where Scotty's like, wait a minute, why does she have this necklace? And then he could start to think on it and whatnot. And I think, I don't know, to me, I think that would have been like an, I think that would have been like an amazing, mind-blowing reveal to show that necklace at that time, yeah, not knowing, yeah, who she was. So that's when it would be.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would have been really interesting, and I think really affecting and suspenseful. And I think that would have been, yeah. I think to me, I think there's really, like, I would love to see it that way as well. I love the way that it's in the movie because I like that, you know, we get to see all the makeover stuff through Judy's eyes, and mm-hmm. we get to see a lot of Scotty's obsession through her eyes and her sort of inner torment of, I'm in love with him, but he wants to make me over into someone else again. Mm-hmm. And again, I have to play this role of Madeline. Because all of her protests, I think, mean so much more, you know, when she's in the salon or when she's in the department store. I think her protests mean so much more because it's her now wondering, does he love me for me or for this role that I played? And again, I have to put on this charade and I have to play this role. So I absolutely agree that having him see the necklace and having that be the reveal would have been amazing. I have no doubt about that. I have nothing against that as a concept. But I do think that you will lose some of the emotional tension and sort of the psychological torture and torment that Judy goes through. And I think that it would just be a different movie. Right.
Yeah. It totally would. Like, I mean, you're at the point where you've said you've watched this movie like 20 times, right?
20 times.
So, like,
yeah.
I guess, like, the way that I am watching it here is only effective on a first watch, and that's the only way that I can consider it. But just picture this on a first watch where we don't know that Judy played Madeline. And so Scotty is starting to fall in love with her because she looks like Madeline. And he starts to ask Madeline, I want you to change your appearance. And she's protesting it. And as the viewers, we're like, we're protesting it because she doesn't want to be made up to look like some other woman that this man loves.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And then on your first rewatch, you're like, no, she's protesting because she's already played this role.
Yeah.
And it like adds a whole other interpretation of it and whatnot. You know, and you, I don't know, you get that on the first viewing instead of the other one. I don't know. So it's 6 1/2 as the other. I mean, I'm sure the 20th time I've seen this, I'm going to be like, well, whatever. I already know anyway.
Yeah, yeah. But, and I mean, I think that, like, that's become such a, you know, point of discussion for, and I think for a good reason in that, like, there's really no right, to me, there's no right or wrong way to do it. I think both ways would have been extremely exciting. And I think that, you know, in the version where he finds out and we find out at the same time with the necklace, it would have been mind-blowing, as we were saying, absolutely, because you wouldn't even guessed it. So I would love to see that version as well, because I think that would have been really, really fun to watch.
Because, like, when I was a kid, right, there's Matlock and there's Columbo, and I always liked Matlock, because in Matlock, they would show the murder, but we'd never see who did the murder.
So
the whole episode is trying to figure out who did the murder, and in Columbo, I think it was, they'd always show the murderer committing the murder, right? And you'd see who it was, and then it was all about Columbo figuring out who the guilty person is, right? And so, like, it's just, they're two tonally different stories being told.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's all. But I mean, like, let's go back to the sequence at the beginning where he's following Madeline for the first time. Like, what an amazing sequence this is. Like, it's so quiet. There's, like, very little dialogue for an extremely long portion of this film. And, you know, we're, like, I'm completely captivated, like, what's going on, right? Why is this person going to these places? What's happening? Why are they sitting here looking at these things? And, I mean, like, this is so well written because you don't see the twist coming, but it's like, why is this person checking out all this stuff? And I really love that sequence of the film. I don't know. To me, it doesn't drag. It's beautiful. It's so, so, so well directed.
Yeah. I think the music is so romantic, but kind of in like an eerie way. And I love this. I love that sequence as well. I think it's like about 12 minutes with no dialogue. I think I clocked it once. Maybe, like, I think 8 to 12 minutes, somewhere around there, if I remember correctly. And it's absolutely so beautiful. And I love when he follows her into the cemetery. I don't know if you remember this, but, like, there's, like, kind of, like, a waxy sheen over the camera when he's in the cemetery. I think that's really cool. I love the shot where he is in the flower shop, and you see him looking out, and then like, you see her in the mirror reflection of the door. Mm-hmm. It's another great shot. I think it's really interesting, and I think what's really cool about this movie is that it kind of gives you this, like, gothic horror movie, like, gothic mystery movie in the first half, because you're wondering, like, is this woman actually possessed? Like, who is Carlotta? Like, you get this, like, really great, like, kind of melodrama story about, you know, the illegitimate child and kind of being, like, abandoned by your rich lover. I mean, I'd watch that miniseries, actually. The History of Carlotta. Would love to watch that. But then you realize you don't even know how much of that is real. I mean, he says it's, like, half real, half, you know, fantasy or something. I think Gavin says that. Someone says that, like, the Carlotta story was, like, half... maybe it's actually Judy. So it's, like, you're kind of being... You and Scotty are both being, like, fooled. Because you got... For me, at least, I get into the gothic horror story, you know, where she's having these trances in the woods and afraid of a grave that's waiting for her. I mean, that stuff is, like, so gothic, so very cool. And you kind of fall for it, and then you're like, oh, wait, I was just kind of hoodwinked into believing this fantastical, supernatural story.
See, for me, for that whole gothic storyline, like, my interpretation of the story going in is, like, this is all true, this is story, because of the necklace in the picture, right? Like, to me, like, that's the one piece. Like, I mean, I realize the whole story could be made up and the necklace is still there, but, like, yeah, I guess I would assume that whole story is true, right? So... Anyways, Chris, what did you think? How did the sequence work for you with no dialogue? Did that work for you?
Oh, I mean, it's absolutely incredible. It's this, like you said, it's this gothic, haunting, sort of creeping dread, but it is also romantic because it is shot so beautifully and scenes like in the flower market and, you know, the painting and everything, they're so vivid in terms of colour. And this is one of the films with Hitchcock where he... really uses colour to great effect to sort of evoke, you know, romance, or if it's dread, or if it's desire. So, like, in Vertigo, he really uses green a lot as this colour of desire that he ties to Madeline a lot. So, you know, the scene in the restaurant, which is this vivid red, there's lots of greens that pop through, there's lots of greens in that flower shop sequence, and then in... probably my favourite sequence, which we might talk about in a bit, it's the when he forces Judy to transform into Madeline sequence. Mm-hmm. And when she steps out of the bathroom, she's covered in this sort of green ethereal haze that's been sort of put over the camera. And it's sort of this idea of, like, oh, a fantasy that you thought was lost being brought back to you, this sort of resurrection. The silent sequence that I think is just absolutely stunning, and you get to see a lot of San Francisco in it, and you get to see these incredible landmarks, and it's just a great example of visual storytelling, which Hitchcock is obviously, you know, known to do. There's plenty of silent sequences in Rear Window, in North by Northwest, in all these kind of fantastic films, but it's really takes on this sort of gothic romantic element, which I don't think we've really seen from him before.
Okay, where should we go next on this one here? Like, this movie's, it's dense, right? But in, like, we could talk forever here, but we gotta kind of wrap it up at some point here. So, Manish, what else is there, anything else you want to address here that we haven't talked about yet?
I was just looking at an article I wrote about this movie a while ago. Trying to think if there's anything else I missed. I just wanted to give a shout out to Kim Novak, because I consider her to be, I think, one of my favorite Hitchcock leading ladies. I think her performance gets more and more layered and affecting the more I see it. You know, she's not, I don't think she gets the same amount of, you know, recognition as a Grace Kelly or Eva Marie Saint type. I don't think she was as big as, I mean, I know she was a big star, but she didn't have the, I don't think she has that same kind of, like, cultural influence as, you know, Grace Kelly or Ingrid Bergman. But I really thought that, I really think she's a wonderful actress. She's still alive. She's living in, I think, in Oregon. Just like, I think she's also an extremely cool lady, because she was, like, okay, I'm done with Hollywood. Now she's like a painter and she rides horses in Oregon. I mean, this is the life, you know. and she's just like, I think it's so cool when celebrities are just like, all right, bye, you know, like Gene Hackman or whatever, and they're just like, you know, they're done with the whole Hollywood scene. So I just wanted to give her a shout out. I mean, I think, you know, I would be interested to see Vera Miles in the role. I can't imagine it just from what I've seen of her. You know, in Psycho, I just listened to your The Wrong Man episode. I mean, I think she's a fabulous actress. I don't want to diminish her talents, but I think this is really Kim Novak's role. I think she has that same. She's able to be that mysterious, kind of cold, distant Madeline, and also this very earthy, you know, sexy Judy. So I think she's fabulous. James Stewart is one of my guys, you know, of the era. I love him. I love his Hitchcock movies. I think they're all amazing. I also just listened to your The Man Who Knew Too Much episode, which I was arguing with you in my head while listening. but, you know, I'll have to forgive you for it.
Wait, which one of us?
I don't remember who, but whoever was saying that the old one was better than the remake, I do not agree. I think the remake is spectacular. And I was like, man, I wish I had known. That's awesome. I wish I had the foresight to ask to be on that episode. It would have been a... Yeah, I mean...
I would say that's me. Like, we're still friends, but, like, we'll have to agree to disagree on that one. Don't worry.
Yeah. it's okay. I still love you. I still love you all. I'm glad to be here. But no, I mean, I really the cinematography in this movie, costume design. You know, the fabulous black dress and green scarf or shawl, green shawl. Mm. I mean, wish I could pull that off, but I don't. I don't have the shoulders for it. I think to pull off a shawl like that. but yeah, so I mean, I love this movie. I've seen it so many times. I will defend it to my dying day. Really glad to be here and that you both enjoyed the film. And I really hope that, you know, you watch it again and again and again and appreciate it the way that I do. But I was really glad to hear both of your thoughts on the film too, and to have this discussion.
Well, Manish, I think we can both agree that this is definitely better than both versions of The Man Who Knew Too Much.
Yeah, that's for sure.
I think we'd all agree on that one.
I mean, I love the 34 version. It is not as good as Vertigo, but I have to be like, no, it's got its place. Like, the 56 one has its place.
Yeah, yeah.
But if it was like a Squid Game kind of fight to the death, I'd really love that Squid Game has now become, like, overtaken Hunger Games. Right. Battle Royale. It's like, no. It's Squid Game. If it was like a fight to the death, yeah, Vertigo would beat its head in with a rock.
Yeah.
And I'm at peace with it. So,
that's funny.
Yeah.
Now, okay, so something you said, Manish, there. Okay, you guys. What is the better Hitchcock doubleheader? Okay, I got three options for you here, okay? Vertigo and Psycho, because of the protagonist switch. Vertigo and the Birds, because of the quiet tones. Or Rebecca and Vertigo, because of the gothic. What's the better doubleheader?
Oh, man. I will be tossing and turning over this one all night.
Oh, man, that's... Okay.
I'm going to say Rebecca and Vertigo, I think, would be the better doubleheader, I think.
I think that's where I'm leaning, because if you... Yeah, because they're both tales about kind of obsession with women who have died, but they're sort of from different perspectives.
Yeah, then I'll be different then, because I agree with that 100%. but just to liven up the conversation, I'll say that... I would love to watch Vertigo with Psycho because of the protagonist switch. Because I think that is a... I think that's a really interesting structural similarity that I didn't think of that until, like, the 15th time I saw the movie, you know? So I think it's something that I don't think people really pick up on when they first see it. And I mean, I guess when I say people, I mean myself. When I was 20 years old, didn't just flew over my head. So I would love to like host that doubleheader and then have a talk and then blow people's minds.
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent. Yeah. Right on. I mean, Hitchcock, man, we love him. That's why we're here. Like this movie was great. I mean, like, the two small nitpicks I have, they definitely don't take away from my rating. Manish, why is this a 6 out of 5 for you?
It's a 6 out of 5 because there's just no movie like it. I don't know. I just, like, it's so singular for me. And I think it has so many interesting influences. I think another interesting doubleheader would be Gone Girl. I think of that as a Vertigo homage in a lot of ways, because you have you kind of have a woman playing two roles. You know, Amy's playing both the, you know, amazing Amy, perfect wife, you know, dream cool girl, and then she's also like her real self, which is like, you know, sociopath murderer. So I like to think, oh my god, have you guys seen Reminiscence with Hugh Jackman and Rebecca Ferguson?
No.
Yes.
That movie is like almost beat by beat homage to Vertigo in a way that I was like dying. Yep. I was like, I know people don't like this movie that much, but like as a Vertigo stan, someone who's obsessed with Vertigo, I was very happy. And I was like, if I had any influence in the film criticism, you know, sphere, any kind of cachet, I would love to have interviewed the director and writer of the film to ask her about that, because I think that is, I think her homages to Vertigo were so clear and I think really cleverly done. So if you've not seen that film, Brandon, I'd recommend it, especially through the lens of Vertigo.
Okay. What's it called again?
Yeah.
Reminiscence.
Okay.
I'm gonna say, yeah, it's like Vertigo meets Waterworld.
Yeah.
With the setting.
I'm all in.
And Lisa Joy's great, so yeah.
2 5-star films. Waterworld and Vertigo. Anyways, awesome. Manish, thank you so much for joining us. I'm very happy you were able to join us for this discussion here. It's been wonderful. There's been a lot of great things. And I loved this movie. This was awesome. Please tell the listeners where they can find you online and tell them about your podcast, please.
Yeah. So the best place to find me is on Twitter at TheManish89. That's TheManish89, where you can find me tweeting about movies, usually making a lot of dumb jokes that I think are very funny, but, you know, jury's still out on some of them. And also Letterboxd. Just find me by my name, Manish Mathur. Also, like, I don't really take my reviews seriously there, but they're a lot of fun. My 2 podcasts. So I host a podcast, It Pod to Be You, which is about romance films. I dedicated an entire episode on Hitchcock, talking about Rear Window and other Hitchcock love stories, including Vertigo, Notorious, and Rope, I think. That was with my friend Erica. So check that out because that's a really fun episode. We really go deep on Hitchcock, especially Rear Window, because I think Rear Window is Hitchcock's like big marriage movie. It's a movie about marriage, it's about commitment. It's a fun episode. Also, I co-host a podcast called Queer Now with my friend Dave Giannini, where we talk about queer films every year. Both of those podcasts are on Twitter. You can find them there. They're on hiatus for the time being, just because our schedules haven't been able to record together. However, I think, I don't know, I'm hoping to at least bring back A Pod to Be You in the new year. We'll see how that goes, but that's the plan. There's the full libraries are available. Also, in the A Pod to Be You feed is my miniseries on M. Night Shyamalan. We just covered Old, which came out almost 2 months ago, 3 months ago. So that's there as well, if you are interested in hearing me talk about M. Night. That's pretty much the best. Those are the places to go.
Chris, where can people find you when you're not, falling in love with Scotty and,
When I mean, I was absolutely, and I feel bad that I didn't get a chance to make the joke, that of all the prestigious awards this film has, it's also Blake Lively's favourite ever movie twist.
Okay.
And it's Matt. It was in her 73 questions, and it's just stuck with me because when I watched it for the first time, I didn't know what the twist was, and I went, "Holy!" And you know, you can't see this, dear listeners, but I just mouthed a very bad swear word. But no, when I'm not busy reacting to Vertigo, when I'm too busy staring into paintings of my own face with glasses on and a beautiful tea dress, you can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy, where I just kind of exist and kind of react to stuff and just chat about pop culture and movies and books occasionally and just kind of, you know, talk to amazing people. So yeah, you can find me there. I have no real other projects going on at the moment. I'm on, there's a Fringe podcast I'm on called Observing the Pattern, and I'm on there kind of semi-frequently, and those episodes are coming out fairly soon, so you might want to check that out. But yeah, just come say hi.
And as for me, you can find me with my other podcasts, Infinite Diversity, a Star Trek Universe podcast, and Franchise Fatigue, a movie about movies, remakes, and sequels. Those are over on my own podcast network called the United Federation of Podcasts. And yeah, I guess that's really all that I'm doing right now, just the three podcasts. So thank you so much to the Fandom Podcast Network.
Sorry, I love that you're like, oh, it's just the three podcasts. I'm like, I'm there going, that sounds exhausting. And you work full time, bloody hell. And you have children.
I have children, yes. It's a lot of fun. You know, it is going to be nice when, like, I'm sad because the end of this podcast is coming near, but, you know, I'm kind of happy that it's coming near because it'll be something off my plate, but then I'm also sitting here thinking, okay, what other topics can we cover when we get to the end of the movie series? So, you know.
I mean, the ultimate solution is just to basically close this out and then on the last episode go, great, so we're doing something else. It's literally the same thing, but we're just doing, like, a different director or a different topic.
Well, it's
because I will happily do
Manish this. Did yeah. his M. Night Shyamalan, and somebody said, we've been a good evening, so what we should do next is an M. Night Shyamalan and call it good night.
Okay, so. I'm all about that. I want to be on every episode.
Yeah.
Well,
I love it. It's just basically, we're setting up a separate podcast now. Just like, oh, yeah.
As long
then you could do Good Day and do Doris Day movies.
Oh, there you go, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. I'll finally, because I've been on a cruise with my family, and my dad, out of earshot of me, was explaining to my grandma what I do. And I'm like, this is weird and trying to embarrassing. But then we got into a conversation about classic Hollywood, and we were actually able to kind of go, oh, yeah, no, I love this. And I look, you know, like the 30s and 40s and all that sort of thing. And talking about like Doris Day and everything. So I'm like, oh, this might be the thing that kind of explains to kind of what I do in my free time.
Yeah.
Rather than just going like, no, it's like radio, but free.
Yeah. Don't forget to check out our good friends Annie and Catherine and their podcast, Good Evening, and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. They're probably still on their hiatus here. Going to be for a couple of months as Annie just had her baby. And yes, so thank you so much to our good friend Jason Cullimore for creating our wonderful theme music. And thanks to the fellows over at the Phantom Podcast Network for helping to host our show in their feed. And then we also have it in our own independent feed. You find Tom on Twitter at TomCaldwell3000. His Instagram is TomCaldwell. And yeah, I guess next week, you know, we're coming up to the Christmas season here, but our next episode of this show is going to be a dip in the pool for another wonderful Hitchcock Presents episodes. So until then, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.